And the podcast begins with a song of rebellion.
How can this
podcast
be my life?
CD Burners.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to CD Burners. We are so back, and we have a great album that we're talking about on today's episode.
It's, you like really put the podcast voice into the...
The intro?
Yeah, into the intro.
I got to, you know, I got to get in the zone. I put the headphones on. I'm like fully dialed.
It's strange because I noticed that too. As soon as you put the headphones on, as soon as you're in front of a microphone, the way that you talk, you like inherently change.
You're in world.
We're doing a great album today. We are doing a fantastic album today.
This CD right here, folks. From Under the Dork Tree from Fallout Boy.
From Under the Pork Tree. And I hope that you have some stats for me, because I didn't focus on the stats. I did a really, really, really intensive going back like 10 years into Reddit and looking at like what the fans were saying.
Yeah, I'm a little bit scared because Fallout Boy fans are so intense. And, you know, we are obviously very familiar with Fall Out Boy. Take This to Your Grave is one of the first albums that I ever bought. This album was maybe, you know, the last one that I was sort of like super into. And then I kind of just fell off a little bit. Obviously, there's the big hits that everybody is familiar with from their whole catalog. But I just know how intense Fall Out Boy fans are. And please, you know, don't come for us. We're doing our best. We're trying to learn. And this is the podcast of misinformation.
But if some of the stuff that I say is wrong, it's from you guys. Because I got a lot of my information from you guys. I actually kind of want to start off with an old Reddit post that I read.
Sure.
It's a quote from something that I found like deep in the Fall Out Boy From Under the Cork Tree, like the thread when it came out. And I think it kind of encapsulates what this whole thing is. And this is not, I didn't say this. This is not a reporter. This is a Reddit post. And it goes, "This album is perfect. I think it's their best. It's certainly their most popular. Even if you don't personally like it as much as some of their later stuff, there's no denying how much of an impact it had. It's really hard to point any particular album as the spark that caused the pop-punk emo explosion in the mid-2000s, and we had stuff like Bleed American and Three Cheers before this, of course. But this is definitely one of the big ones. Cork Tree came out before A Fever You Can't Sweat Out, before the Black Parade, and before Riot, and so many other staples in the genre. And is it wonder why it's so popular? It's way more polished than the majority of the stuff that came before it. Stump's vocals are absolutely breathtaking and emotional, and the instruments are catchy as fuck. But the lyrics still have that raw cynicism and poetry that drew so many people to the band and to the genre as a whole. The trade-off is that it's not as experimental as some of their stuff that followed. It's mainstream and a little on the safe side. And I think a lot of hardcore fans kind of resent the album sometimes for that reason. I totally get that, but do you know what? I still belt out the words to Sugar We're Going Down every time it comes on, even though I've heard it 10,000 times before." I thought that was a really nice, you know, they're fans. This is what I learned about Fall Out Boy fans. They are really smart. And they have like a, put on Do Not Disturb.
Hey, you don't know what I'm doing over here.
I don't know what you're doing. But that is the one thing that I really admired about Fall Out Boy fans, is that they are smart. They were able to look at things objectively. They were like, okay, this might not be my favorite album from Fall Out Boy, but I understand why it's so important, and I understand why it might be your favorite album from Fall Out Boy. And that was like pretty much the through line reading through all of the fan stuff. And I really like that. Like, I really, really like when you can see both sides of things and not just be like, this sucks or this is the best, without like giving some sort of explanation to it. And the majority of the posts that I read, the fans were like pretty dead on. They were fucking like spot on with their opinions. You know, like even like this person said, "It might not be my favorite, but I can understand why it is the best."
Well, this was the second full-length album from Fall Out Boy. It came out May 3rd, 2005. on Island Records. It was their first debut on a major label. This is what people consider their breakout album.
You know what was really interesting about this album? Is that what? You said, like, what did you say something about Billboard?
Nope.
Not yet?
Nope.
It was their breakout album, but like the thing that happened that was so like prolific, it was like squeezed between.
That's not the right word again. You used it wrong last week
what
too.
What is the word that
prolific just means that you put out a lot. Like you're putting out music like every month or every week.
Okay, well then I'll say the lyrics on this album are prolific.
That's not the right thing.
It's a lot of lyrics.
No, prolific just means you put out things like at a high frequency. If Fall Out Boy was putting out an album every 2 months, they would be considered a prolific band.
Okay. Do you guys know what I'm trying to say? But I think what was so fucking awesome about this is like it charted and it was stuck in between artists like Pretty Ricky and Bow Wow. It was like when it charted, it was like in between those things. And I think that that is like a really telling of this album and like how popular it got.
It was sitting in between those two albums at number 9 on the Billboard 200. So they sold 168,000 records and they stayed there at that spot for 2 weeks. It was the band's first top 10 album. So it's their longest time that they spent on the chart and their best-selling album. Ended up being on the chart. It logged 14 weeks in the top 20. So it was on the chart for 78 weeks. And of those 78 weeks, 14 of them were in the top 20.
Did you know that it wasn't initially, like, when it first came out, it, like, didn't do as well as, and then it started to do fucking awesome because of the Sugar We're Going Down music video?
I did read that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It, like, when it came out, it, like, it did well. Like, it was not that it didn't do well, but, like, the video fucking propelled that motherfucker.
It sure did.
When was the last time that you, there was, like, a music video that kind of took the world by a chokehold? When was that? Because now it's so fucking, like, it's so interesting that an album like a music video like that could do that to this album. And I don't remember the last time I've like seen a memorable music video. I have one, but I want to know when the last time that you think.
Well, this was 20 years ago. So they were actually still playing music videos on MTV. So I don't know that, you know, music videos have that sort of like mainstream boom effect that they do now. I'm trying to think of like a modern day YouTube music video.
The fact that you like are having to think about it is that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like I remember the last music video that everybody was talking about, like full music video, was the Childish Gambino music video.
Yeah. Yeah.
That like popped off and that was like what, like 2018 maybe?
Yeah. That, and then there was like that Taylor Swift like Reputation video where she had like Kendrick Lamar on the track and she brought in a whole bunch of celebrity cameos. That one was that was around the same time though, like 2018, 2017.
Yeah, it's like what music video could possibly do that to an album now? And I would love for that to happen because I love music videos, but it's just not the same way that we ingest information. I just thought that that was really a cool thing then showed the power of music videos at this time.
Well, you know that they hated the video?
I didn't know that.
It was in the book, Where Are Your Boys Tonight? And I remembered reading it. And the guys got the treatment for the video and they thought that it was like pretty decent. And then they made the video, got it back, and they thought it was so horrible that they were already crafting a plan for the next video, which was their sort of like redemption video. I guess there was a scene in Jay and Silent Bob where they like find the IP addresses of everybody who talks shit about them on the internet, and then they go and like kick their ass. So that was going to be the next video that Fall Out Boy was anticipating they were going to have to make because they were like, oh, this video is so bad. People are going to hate it so much. Our next video should be us going around and kicking people's ass, like finding their IP address for talking shit on us on the internet and then kicking their ass.
Did they? Then they did not make that video.
No, because they thought the video was going to be a flop, and they were like, well, it's too late. We got to just put the video out. So let's at least be like prepared to make the follow up.
It's crazy because there is so much stuff like that surrounding this album, like where they're like, it's going to not do great, or like there was so much anticipation of them not knowing if it was going to be awesome or not and how people were going to receive it. Like even the dude that, like, you know, initially got the producer on it initially was like, nah.
Neil.
Like he initially got like these first like two demos of it and he was like, he passed on it. And then initially, and then he like came back and they gave him like a little bit clearer sounding songs. I think they gave him like Sugar, but like it sounded way different.
I don't know if that's right, because I read that they like wrote Sugar, I think 10 days before they went into the studio.
Here, I read a lot of different things about Sugar.
Yeah.
I read that
the label was trying to shelve it because they were like, oh, you can't understand the chorus.
Yeah, it's like too wordy. Yeah. And that's, which again, fucking, it's one of the things that drives me insane about people that aren't in it all day, every day and creating it. You know, they're just hearing it and being like, this isn't what people are going to like. And you're taking an artist that is an actual like artist and being like, this is good. We believe in it. And look what happened. And like somebody up top being like, I don't, like one person being like, I don't get it. Like, that's too wordy, which it is fucking a wordy chorus. I literally didn't know the words to the.
Nobody does.
Like,
it's become a meme at this point, you know?
We sing it every fucking emo night. We start the goddamn show with this song every time, and I still don't know the fucking words. So, like, I understand that person's perspective, but you have to trust the artist. And when you trust the artist, this is what happens.
It's true, but they're definitely, that's like why the job of A&R exists. That's like why there are A&R people at labels to push back and be that sort of like person who helps them hone it creatively.
But they tried to like stop this chorus from happening.
Sure. There's a lot of fights that happen between A&Rs and artists, and sometimes it's like for the best and sometimes it's not.
I wonder where, have we done anyone where there's like an A&R that like made the wrong?
Yeah, we did.
Which one?
I feel like we definitely talked about it. I think on the Sleeping With Sirens record, they picked
a bummer
of a single.
Yeah, you're right.
And in that same book that I read, this is for another episode when we do Jimmy Eat World, but the A&R of DreamWorks that worked on that album made a legendary mistake. And we can talk about it when we get to that record.
Well, guys are just going to have to fucking wait.
Even he, in that book, Where Are Your Boys, he's like, I think that was the biggest mistake of their career, my career. If I had done that, they would be a way bigger band than they are.
I mean, I can't imagine what that chorus would sound like. They like fucking, I think I read somewhere, again, the fucking podcast of misinformation. Like I read somewhere that like Pete and Patrick really fought about that chorus. They really fought about it to the point where like Pete was like documenting the recording process during the time. And like Patrick like punched the camera. Like it got like physical.
Yeah, I did hear that they like physically fought.
Which is crazy. We've never physically fought.
You know, it's very clear when you actually open this up and you look at the liner notes, they definitely, I think, were kind of working it all out and how the system was going to work in the band. Because from what I gathered, I could be wrong, the physical fights mostly happened on Take This to Your Grave. And then at this point, it was, okay, I'm going to do the music, I'm going to do the melody, you're going to do the lyrics. And you can see in the credits here, it says, all music by Patrick Stump and Fall Out Boy, all lyrics by Pete Wentz. So I think that was sort of like the first album, they were definitely fighting more, there was some give and take, they were definitely like co-writing. And then at this point, they were like, all right, if we're going back in, this is the system. You got to let me have control of the lyrics. You can literally write everything else. But Pete would sit there in the booth with him and, you know, try and fit these words into these melodies.
Which is it's crazy that Patrick does it. And yeah, we just saw him live in Madison Square Garden. They sound so fucking good. And like, I'm like blown away at the musicianship of this band. Like when this, also, I don't want to forget this, but I didn't know that that was the case. I didn't know that Pete wrote all the lyrics and Patrick wrote the music. I had no idea. And then I was like, what other bands have done that? There has to be other bands that have done that. And I don't know who Bernie Taupin is, but he did that. Rush does that. And Elton John.
Hmm.
It's like a switched thing. There's somebody
Elton
else.
Elton John and Bernie Taupin, they work together, right? They're a songwriting partnership.
Yeah, I just have like other artists where band members wrote the lyrics. So it was like Elton John and Rush mainly. I wonder how that works and how like Patrick feels about...
There's actually a New York Times article called The Frontman in the Background. And they talk about this sort of weird dynamic that Pete Wentz and Patrick Stump have, because Pete is, you know, the better looking, more charismatic member. He's like, I'll take the spotlight. I'll do the interviews. I'll be this sort of personality. And Patrick is more than okay with that. He likes it. He just wants to make music. He's a big, big music nerd. He loves R&B. He loves soul. And he is content with just making the tunes.
I mean, he's an awesome front man. He really is a fucking... I, like, give all the credit in the entire world to that band. This is the first time I ever saw them. And, like, I really was impressed. Like, I remember... That was one of the things, like, what you just said. You're like, oh, he likes all this shit. Likes all this different shit.
Mm-hmm.
I remember trying to, like, a fucking whatever site it was, like, Ultimate Guitar, trying to, like, play some of these songs. And they sound... They're so catchy that you think that you're like, this shouldn't be... This should be, like, a Blink thing. This was one of the ones that I distinctively remember giving up on and being like, I'm not going to do that. Like, the fucking parts are hard. And to like watch, and I remembered that when we were watching them, and he's playing it and singing it perfectly. And I was like, damn, dude, this guy's fucking good at shit.
Well, let's talk about some of the central themes on this record, because the lyrics are pretty dark. There's a lot of anxiety and depression. And, you know, at some point between Take This to Your Grave and this album, Pete lost his mind and tried to kill himself.
Yeah. I read that, which is like, this is the cool thing about doing this podcast. I'm sure a lot of Fall Out Boy fans are like reading or watching this and know that. Like, I just didn't know that. And so I like looked into it and said that he did it in a Best Buy parking lot.
He was trying to overdose on Ativan.
If I ever do that, it'll probably be at like the Shoe Palace.
They still have that?
Yeah, dude. There's a Shoe Palace on Hollywood Boulevard or Sunset. It's Hollywood, I think on Sunset, Hollywood.
Okay.
So you guys can find me at the Shoe Palace. That's where I would do it.
All right. I'm going to watch your Find My
Friends.
I
did read about this album that they were afraid that if they didn't make the changes that they did to this album, that they would never would make those changes. And so it was like, had to take that and actually do it.
They like, were like what?
Like taking the, making it into what this album is, like how drastically different it sounds. They're like afraid that if they never did it, it would never be Fall Out Boy. Like it would never like find their sound.
I still don't know what you mean.
So like the album that came before this sounds like they were taking chances on like writing the songs that sound the way they do from this album, from the last album. It was like these artistic changes that people were like, this is vastly different than that album. And that's where the direction that they wanted to move in. And I think that they're afraid of being stuck. If they didn't do it on this album, that's where they would like stay.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, the albums after this are way more different.
So fucking different.
Did you hear about this? I know. So this was their first... This was their first album on a major label, but sneakily, it like kind of wasn't. Did you hear about this?
No, but so, I love that though.
So Fueled by Ramen the first record came out on Fueled by Ramen, but it was like kind of like a feeder program to
what does that mean?
Island Records. Like they were pretty much on the island the whole time. Island gave them the money to make that first record. They just like wanted to have street cred, to be on like an independent label. And then once stuff got going, they were like, all right, we'll do this through Island now. Like if they had put out Take This to Your Grave with the label that said Island, it wouldn't have been critically received by the scene because they would have just been like, oh, these fucking major label bozos, you know?
I learned a lot about Pete in this, in the research that we were doing. And let me tell you, I feel a lot like Pete sometimes. I'm basically Pete.
How so?
He's about the same size as me.
He is 5'5".
But I am with these boots on, man. You know? Mm-hmm. And it feels good. But, like, he was always really, really into being like, what is next? Like, what's happening next? He was really tapped in to, like, that is something that I feel like, I don't know if that was his decision to do or not.
It was.
It sounds like something that's like, dude, he's really smart. He's really, really smart, and he's really tapped in and really pushes for what he believes in. And I very much respect that. It's like to be so connected to what he believes is cool. And it really, I didn't know how much he did.
Yeah, it was his vision.
Yeah,
from the very beginning.
Did not know that, you know?
It came out, you know, these are like hardcore guys. They were playing in like hardcore bands in Chicago next to Hatebreed. And Fall Out Boy started kind of as a joke, but I think Pete was like, you know what? This is like my ticket to get huge and to like get famous. And he had the vision from the start, and they were kind of, you know, a joke. Like they would play these like big festivals with all these hardcore bands, and then they would come up and, you know, they referred to themselves as Chicago softcore, you know.
You can tell now, especially now since like knowing them a little bit better and like really paying attention to them recently, like they're fucking funny guys, dude. They are funny guys. The way like when they go on like music award shows, when they like dress up, when they do like late night television shit, like I don't know, to me Fall Out Boy is kind of the entire package. They do give a little bit of like, whether it's intentional or not, like they give a little bit of boy band.
Well, did you see there's a quote from Patrick Stump about this, when people are like, oh, they're just like a boy band, they're a boy band in pop punk. And he was like, we're not a fucking boy band. Like, if we were a boy band, every single one of us would be good looking. Like, I'm a fat guy. He literally says, like, I'm fat.
Dude, he's awesome. Patrick fucking rocks. But whether or not, like, he sees it that way, that might be true in his eyes. It's not true in the fans' eyes. Like, they love him. They don't care if he is a fat guy. They don't care if he, whatever. You know, this band is, like, everybody has their favorite person in this band, right? Like, and that, to me, like, is kind of the ethos of boy band stuff. And like, regardless of like what Pete thinks of himself, dude, my fucking For You page on Twitter is like Pete fan club from like a small, like every single fucking region you could ever, like, I don't know, Pete fan club from Costa Mesa, California, right? It gets like recommended to me. It's like, he is in their eyes like the person that he might not think that he is. And so that kind of is boy band. I can tell you that my favorite member is Andy.
Andy Stan?
I'm an Andy Stan, dude.
Let's jump into some fast facts about the record. A lot of these people know, but I'm going to just, you know, do them in case people don't know them.
I need to know them.
Number one, the first track on this album is called Our Lawyer Made Us Change the Name of This Song So We Wouldn't Get Sued. It was originally named My Name Is David Ruffin, and These Are the Temptations.
Hilarious.
But their lawyer told them they would get sued.
Funny. So, it's awesome.
The album title comes from a children's book called The Story of Ferdinand, about this, I think it's like a hippo or something, that wants to just sit under the cork tree and not be involved.
This is the podcast of misinformation. That I do not remember. I do not know if it was a hippo.
It was.
It was?
I don't know.
Like, yeah, don't.
They did get sued by another person.
I do know this.
Wesley Isold.
From American Nightmare.
I didn't Google who he was, so you tell me.
American Nightmare is fucking awesome. They're a hardcore band. Every once in a while, they come back and do like... I remember when they reunited and did their last show, like, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, and every single one of my friends flew in to wherever this was to go see it. It was American Nightmare is like a huge, like, you know, they're pretty like staple up there in hardcore.
Got it.
Yeah. And that was the poem, right?
Well, I know that they got sued, I think, from the first record for literally like plagiarizing some of his stuff. And then they reached a settlement or whatever. And now there is a like special thanks to Wesley Isold in the liner notes of this record.
Another little fun fact about that. And I think, again, don't. The what it was the poem that Pete says at the end of one of the songs.
Okay.
And he was so nervous. He wasn't like good in front of a mic or in the booth. He couldn't do that poem. That's why it sounds like super different than the rest of the album, because he had to go in the bathroom in the dark and do it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There you go.
The album cover here, if you take a close look, you can see it's a van stuck in the snow. This is a reference to a car crash that the band got into on their way to film the music video for Grand Theft Autumn. They were driving to New York City. The album has lots of movie references, including Casablanca, Dirty Dancing, 16 Candles, 7 Minutes in Heaven, The Shawshank Redemption, and... yeah, that's about it for Fast Facts.
That's it for Fast Facts.
That's all
for
I
you?
Got. You got anything?
I mean, I have stuff like why it's important, you know? Like why I think that this album is important.
Well, that doesn't sound like a fact.
Kind of is a fact. I would say that like my opinions for the most part are pretty fucking dead on. It's a fact. This is fact. These are my facts.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is that it was palatable for a lot of people, and it was like people's introduction into like, oh, there's other music like this? Because you're hearing it, like I said, like on the radio next to like whatever. I think Mariah Carey was top
Lil
up.
Bow Wow.
Yeah, all that shit was up there. And so this was a real introduction to people that were like, oh, like maybe knew of Blink, but were like, nah, not for me. And got to discover so many other bands that did sound like Fall Out Boy, because this got pushed in between all of the other like pop radio shit. And so this was like such an important album for not only this like the scene, but kind of for everybody, for mainstream. It really like got people when it wasn't, you know, we didn't have like share, like shit was shareable all the time. You were like, you know, they were on TRL, dude. They're in like in between like doing Warped Tour, they were going to TRL.
You know, we talked about the music video a little bit earlier, and we talked about you just talking about them being on TRL, their visibility. I have a very vivid memory of where I was when I saw this video for the first time. I was in freshman year of high school, and I was going to some girl's birthday party.
Let's go.
I remember it was like, I don't know how anybody's parents allowed this, but they like brought us up to a ski resort in Utah. It was like the fall. And they rented 2 hotel rooms for the night. And they just had a bunch of 14 and 15-year-old kids staying in these hotel rooms. And her parents, like, weren't really supervising us. But I remember the video came out. It was kind of sick because we were just, like, hooking up.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
But we were...
That rocks.
Yeah, I remember that music video was on in the hotel rooms.
Dude, I actually, like, what you said... right now reminded me of another thing that I put in here from like the fans, like the Reddit fans, because there was a lot, but I really did want to like capture that time and capture like why this is so important. So I'm just going to read, it's a quick one, but summer 2005, I just graduated high school. All my friends were gearing up to go their separate ways. It was a very bittersweet journey. and I had fucked by my side the
fucked.
I didn't realize that. But the entire journey. I remember one summer night, my brother, two friends of ours, and I hopped in a minivan and went on a 30-mile ride out to the countryside to one of our friend's cousin's house for Halo 2 War. It was the four of us against the 10 of them. We kicked ass. It was midnight when we left. The small town we traveled through was eerily empty with the roads lit by orange streetlights. I really enjoyed that moment. The song that was playing during that exact same time was Sophomore Slump or Comeback of the Year. We were all singing along. Whenever I hear that song now, it takes me back to that night, driving through the town, empty, lit by orange streetlights. They say you can never go back to those times nor create those kinds of memories, but damn, I really don't have as many memories that I would have liked during that time. I miss those days.
Yeah, it's a very nostalgic album, I think, for a lot of people because, I don't know, this was the album that you were finding your identity, at least me. Like, I was 15. I was just figuring out how I wanted to dress, like, who I wanted to be, and I was just discovering Fall Out Boy. I remember I was, like, a little bit mad, actually, that they were on MTV, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's...
Because I had, like, such a relationship with them, like, just personally, you know, had a personal relationship. I saw them, like, at a very, very small venue in Salt Lake City on Take This to Your Grave show, like, Take This to Your Grave, and they... It wasn't even like sold out. It was like probably like 250 kids. And my parents drove me. It was the first show I ever went to. I didn't even have my license. My parents drove me.
This was the first show you ever went to?
First like club show.
Damn, that's fucking wild. I don't remember the first show I ever went to.
I went to other concerts, but they were all at like arenas and stuff. But this was like at a club. And my parents drove me and like... They were like, all right, we'll pick you up. And then they went and got dinner, and then they came back. And I remember they were just, like, hanging out outside the venue, like, chatting with the security guards. And it was great. It was awesome. And I remember Pete was, like, fucking jumping off of shit. It was such a great core memory. And I had such a strong connection. I was like, they're so cool, and they're, like, this underground band. And then I was like, why the hell are they on MTV? Why are they on TRL? But I think that was all part of the vision that I was just, you know, falling right into Pete's plan.
I really got to give it to him. Like, he nailed it. It really, 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 like, saw what this band could be and how to take it. And also, at the same time, like, you know, I think that, like, there's a lot of talk about his vision and wanting it to, like, be successful. But at the same time, if you take a listen to the lyrics and, like, actually the musicianship of the album itself, it's a really deep album. And that's why I think it was really palatable for a lot of people, because the vision was there, but the heart was also there. Like, it was a really, really, really solid album. And it was the catalyst for a lot of people.
Speaking of it being such a solid album, what are your standout tracks on this thing?
I didn't know if I was alone, and obviously I'm not alone in this, because, like, everybody fucking loves a ton of these songs, but I love the last song, XO.
Okay.
I think that that is such a fucking good song. But the standout track for me is Nobody Puts Baby in the Corner. Like,
you know?
That,
yeah.
That one, like, it grabs me right away. Like, that was the one where, like, I had that melody in my head
mm-hmm.
for so long when this album came out without knowing who that was.
Well, that song came out on an EP before this album came out. There was an EP that was released somewhere in between Take This to Your Grave and this album that I had, and it had Nobody Puts Baby in the Corner. It had another song, and then it also had like a cover of Love Will Tear Us Apart. And I remember I listened to those four or five songs like a million times.
That's my standout. Those are my standout tracks.
Yeah, Nobody Puts Baby in the Corner is an incredible song.
Speaking of like the catchiness of this album, the way that they... What's the word where sequenced, like mm-hmm. where the order of it?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was so, like, I don't think there's been like a run of the first half of an album being so fucking solid. Like, every single song is so solid. I think it was so smart the way that they sequenced this album, because you listen to the first like four or five songs and you're like, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard easily. And then you get into stuff where you're like, oh, this is a little bit different. This is a little bit different. It might not be my favorite. And you start to love those songs just as much because it's like, that is the order of this. And you get to listen to the ones that like really grab you. So you're like, learn. I think that it was the way that this album is sequenced is probably besides like Jimmy World Clarity, I think it's like, perfectly, like it might be up there with like the top sequenced albums.
You're so right, because the first track, our lawyer made us change the name of this song so we wouldn't get sued. That song just hits you. It hits right out the gate. You hear this and you're like, okay, I'm in. Number two, Of All the Gin Joints in All the World, then it goes into Dance Dance, then Sugar We're Going Down, then Nobody Puts Baby in the Corner.
Dude, fucking nuts.
All
like
five,
a nuts run
hitters.
It's a nuts like first run.
Then they take a risk with I've Got a Dark Alley and a Bad Idea. That song is a little weird.
Which, here's the thing.
Patrick almost cut that.
Let me tell you this. On all of these fan sites, people, that was the one that I kept reading was their favorite song off of this album. And I think, dude, what's so smart is like that song comes right after that fucking sequence of hits. So it's the one that you kind of...
You have the freedom to do something.
And it's also like when you're playing it in order, sequential order off of a CD, like that's the one that comes next. It's a really smart way to sequence an album.
Yeah. I love 7 Minutes in Heaven out of Van Halen, which is a reference to Pete's OD attempt.
You know me, I just love a wordplay, but saying out of Van Halen and like the riff just sounds like Van Halen.
This was
great.
This was like the first album that I remember being like, these titles are so long, and then everybody started to do it. Like they kind of fucking, I think that's also an important thing to note about this time. People weren't like making sentences as titles.
Yeah.
You know, at least not in the mainstream. And after Fall Out Boy did it, we saw so many people fucking do that.
It was such a trend.
I feel like it's really important to note that. Like, I also, do you know who wasn't Brendan Urie on that song?
Yeah, so he wasn't on Out of Van Halen, I don't believe, but I think he was on a little less 16 Candles. I just want, it kind of segues perfectly because it goes back to Pete's vision, I think. And the world building that they're doing, right? So, like, they pull in all of their friends, all the guys that are in The Academy Is, Panic at the Disco, signed to Fueled by Ramen, signed to Decadence. They're, like, building this whole universe, and it's propelling all of their friends up. Like, I was reading in that book, Where Is Your Boy Tonight? Where Are Your Boys Tonight? You know, The Academy Is was just flying. They were like, once they had the Fall Out Boy like check mark, they got rocket boosters on their career. They were bumped up to second on the bill on these tours. So they brought in all their friends. In the music video for A Little Less 16 Candles, you see cameos from William Beckett, Brendan Urie, Mike Carden, Spencer Smith, Travie McCoy, and they even pulled in their security guy and their lighting guy.
It is one of, like, the thing that I'll keep going back to is, like, that vision. Like, wasn't
And you
this...
were right, though. Brendan Urie is on Out of Van Halen.
Thank you, guys. Thank
but
you so much.
But how the hell would you know the difference?
Thank
like,
you so much.
His vocals sound so much like Patrick Stump.
Here's the thing. Like, it was another thing about, like, them being able to see the vision of talent in other people and propelling it. Like, I think that might be that guy's, like, first thing on anything.
Yeah.
And to be like, oh, there is something there, and then bumping it, to see that stuff is a talent.
From what I read about the first Panic at the Disco demos that Pete heard, they were god-awful. And everybody was like, what are you talking about? This is so bad. And somehow he could see through it.
He's got the thing. He has the thing that I'm basically Pete, dude. I'm Pete. You know what I mean? I was going through and I was like, yes, me, you, same shit.
And then the other standouts, I think, you know, Sugar We're Going Down, obviously.
That's why it's our national anthem.
when I was listening to this record with Aaron, and then yesterday I was getting my hair done with our friend Jules, they both asked me the same question. And I wanted to ask you, because I don't know, how did Sugar We're Going Down become the Emo Night National Anthem?
I don't know. I have no idea, but I think why it's such a memorable intro to a song, like, shout out Andy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, such a, like, that you know when that's happening. It's like, if the Black Parade wasn't such, like, a ender of a fucking thing, that would be, like, the first song. Because there's really no other, I think it was, it really is. I think it's just, like, the perfect introduction. You know what it is. Yeah. You don't have to, like.
But it's sequenced fourth here. You know, they could have started the record with that. There's a lot of songs that Fall Out Boy does that start with drums, like Dance Dance starts with drums.
Yeah, I mean, we could have done that. But yeah. I mean, this
but doesn't
was like,
have like the it's power. Just, I don't know what it is.
I don't know. I don't.
But was there ever a moment that you and I and Babs were like,
no, like this is the thing that we're going to do?
This is what we're going to do?
I think we just naturally went into it. I think it was just a natural progression. Of
I feel
like
it didn't happen, though, until maybe 2016. And then, like, we did it once as the first song. And then we were like, that's just got to be the thing. Like, we're going to start with that every time.
I'm sure whatever it was, like, in passing. We were, like, just walking and being like, we should start with that every single time. Because, like, we did a show that went really great, you know? Like, that, to me, sounds like something that we would be like, yeah, and in passing. And then we just do it as, like, a bit. And then it turns into a thing. That's to me, I would assume that's what happened, knowing us. But who knows? You know what I mean? Like, who knows? But that is why it's the first song. And we tell everybody that, you know, does our events, all of our awesome reps that do them in, like, different cities. Like, that's the first song you play.
Oh, yeah. It's in the handbook. Like, when you become a rep to run an emo night for us anywhere in the world, the rule is you play Sugar We're Going Down first. Strict rule.
I also have one more Reddit post to read because I think it really, like, does explain about bridging the gap between people that didn't know this type of music and this music and how important it was. It goes, I remember having a stereo for my 13th birthday with nothing to play it in it but Eminem. I was listening to my cousin's boyfriend's MP3 player and he had a song called Dance Dance. Turns out it was the demo. I asked him who it was by and he told me. I used my allowance and bought the CD. I wasn't into rock at all. But when I heard those camera flashes, I was hooked. The CD did not leave my stereo or CD player until Infinity on High came out.
Wow.
I want to give the album its proper credit for really taking people that would normally not be into this type of music and getting them into it. Like, that was, like, the big thesis of all of my notes.
It definitely was the mainstream explosion.
Dude, there's also a really fucking funny YouTube video that I watched where it was, like, listening to, it was, like, it was recently, it was, like, maybe a couple years ago, and it was, like, listening to Under the Cork Tree for the first time as a Fall Out Boy hater, because it was the album that, like, this girl would only listen to when he was dating this guy. And he self-admittedly was like, I'm a music snob. I am a fucking, like, I was like that. I don't want to be like that anymore. And he listened to the album the entire way through for the first time. He never listened to it. He would turn off all the songs, like, when they came on the radio because it reminded him of his fucking ex-girlfriend. And he was like, it's, you know, at the end, at like, you know, like an hour in, he was like, all right. It's fucking awesome.
Well,
like, really cool to be really like listening to Fall Out Boy for the first time reaction as a Fall Out Boy hater. And I was like,
that's a really funny title for
it's
a video.
Really funny. I fucking saved the YouTube link. So I don't know if we can like put it up or somehow do that shit, but I have it because I thought it was really an interesting watch.
Jumping into the physical CD here, I didn't get a chance to look at this before I did my notes. And it's really annoying how hard it is to find this stuff out without these CDs. And these are going extinct. So we talked about it briefly. Neil Avron produced this album. He mixed most of it as well. It was recorded in Burbank. Couldn't find the name of the studio anywhere except on this. It says Ocean Studios.
Yeah, they said they were in, like, corporate housing. I don't know what the fuck that means.
Yeah, I could not find a expansion on that either.
I don't know what that means.
But, Morgan, if you look at the back of this album, it says all the songs are produced and mixed by Neil Avron, except the ones with the asterisks. And there are five. There are five asterisks. And guess who mixed those?
Was it our friend?
It was our good friend Tom Lord Alge.
Yeah, it's always him. It's always him.
God, we got to get him on the pod.
Dude, I downloaded Ableton like this weekend.
So you're basically Tom Lord Alge now?
I'm basically like a mix of Tom Lord Alge and Pete, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that for sure.
But all the plugins, right? Mm-hmm. Like the vocal plugins are all like, you know, I looked up whatever fucking videos on being like, what's the best plugins for this thing? It's all like
the Tom Lord Alge plugins.
Like plugins, yeah.
So Neil Avron, main producer of this. He has such a weird
discography. His breakout was Everclear's 1997 album, So Much for the Afterglow.
Dude, that guy hates his dad. That guy fucking
hates... Who, Everclear?
Yeah. Everclear hates his dad. Every song is about him like being like, you suck, dad. Yeah, they like fucking... You know what? Like, the emo gets like really like pinned into that fucking... like, I hate my parents sort of deal.
Yeah.
You fucking listen to Everclear. Everclear
did it
first. That guy fucking hates his dad. All of his songs are about it. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's a great, great little tangent there. Maybe we need to have Everclear at emo night.
I mean, I really like Everclear.
He did Yellow Card, Ocean Avenue. He did Weezler. He did Newfound Glory's Catalyst. He did Say Anything by Say Anything. For one moment in 2010... he produced the number one album for 3 weeks in a row. Three different albums debuted number one. He had produced all three. It was the first week, Disturbed, Asylum.
Let's go.
The second week, Cerebrellis, Kaleidoscope Heart.
Dude.
The third week, a Linkin Park's 1,000 Suns.
What a fucking run. A goddamn run, dude.
Yeah, pretty different stuff.
Is Cerebrellis the one that was like, it's like kind of arpeggiated like songs where it's like specific notes and it's a lot of that? Because I remember there is like a lady that around that era that I was like, this album is perfect. And I think it might be hers.
She does the one that's like I'm not going to write you a love song.
Yeah, I think that's her.
If you like this, you might like.
What do you have?
Random one. Taylor Swift, Reputation and Lover. Taylor Swift, when she was doing press for her Reputation, she said on record that Pete Wentz is one of her biggest influences lyrically. She said, when I would listen to Fall Out Boy and study those lyrics, it was just one-liner, zinger after zinger, line after line, and that's where I learned that from. And she talked about a dinner party that she went to with Brendan Urie and Pete Wentz. And she said, I just sat there and I asked them everything. So she's a big fan.
We got to get her at emo night.
She's a fucking emo girl.
We got to get to it. I mean, if you've seen her, like, you've seen the, like, pictures of her.
Yeah.
Like, this shit. Dude, okay. I was having a really difficult time being like, if you like this, who the fuck? What sounds like this? And like, you know, you can go to Spotify and be like, oh, this artist is like this artist. But dude, it's fucking, I wanted it to try and find like a pop punk album that had like this type of feel. At the time, it was like my favorite album and I'm surprised that it like didn't come to me, but it was Midtown. Like Midtown, if you like this album and you never got into Midtown, you somehow missed it. Like, Midtown is fucking amazing.
You know Pete Wentz is the reason that Midtown broke up, right?
No. Why? What happened?
Fall Out Boy was really big into playing end-of-tour pranks. And I forget exactly what they did. I believe they antiqued them on stage on the final night of tour. and they did not think it was funny at all. And they were already like kind of like struggling. They had been touring for a while, and then it was just this. That was like the straw that
broke
the
camel's
back.
And then they
were
like, "Fuck this! We're not going to play in a band anymore."
Yeah.
Damn! Really?
Yeah, it's in that book.
Dude, he's not only the creator; he's the ender.
Yeah.
Of things.
He's too powerful.
Dude, yeah, he's got to be stopped. I feel like I have to stop him. Please listen to Midtown. Like, go back. Midtown has my favorite harmonies out of all of the albums ever. Like, they just were like the kings of harmony, and that's a way to catch me.
There's a lot of good harmonies on here too. Did you get into the extended version of this at all?
No, I did not. But I read all about it. I just didn't want to I wanted to stick to the thing.
Well, I started getting into it a little bit just because I read about a couple random facts of it, and then I was like, okay, I should check this out. There is a song called Snitches and Talkers Get Stitches and Walkers on the extended release. It was supposed to be on here, and it was cut because apparently Pete thought it was too My Chem sounding.
Interesting.
So I was like, I gotta go listen to that. And I listened to it, and I was like, this sounds exactly like Three Cheers My Chem. It's a good song.
But there's an extended version, and it's on it.
That song is not on this version. It's on the reissue. They put out a reissue with four bonus tracks, and I think, two of them are tracks that did not make it on here. And then there's a Patrick Stump remix of Sugar We're Going Down, and then another random remix. The remix is really funny too, because it's really soulful and R&B. It's not dance music.
I'm gonna listen to it right now.
It's pretty good.
Should we play that for the first song next time?
Oh, at E-Money.
Yeah, should I play the remix?
Yeah, we should play the remix and just fuck with people.
All right. I'll do that.
Well, that's about it for me.
I mean, I think I covered basically what I wanted to. There is a lot. There really is a lot. What I really admired about this was their fans. I really did it. Rarely do you see fans being able to take a look at the bigger picture of a thing because they're so fucking honed in on what they like. And I really noticed that in Fall Out Boys, fans were really able to take a look into who they are as a band and not the one specific thing that they particularly like. And that was impressive to me. So shout out Fall Out Boy fans. Don't fucking roast us for getting any of this information wrong.
Shout out to the Overcast Kids. That's what they call the fans. And you can see that down at the very bottom of the liner notes here. It says, to join the Overcast Kids, parentheses, Fall Out Boy fan club, please go to overcastkids.com. I wonder if that's still,
see if it's
still active. It's gotta be.
Let's join.
Let's be Overcast Kids. Page not found. And then it just takes you to the Fall Out Boy mailing list.
Dude, can you buy it?
No, it's still their website. It just takes you to falloutboy.com/mailing list.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to PP Burners. Stay burnt. Stay toasty.
That's something we're doing? No, I like it.
Stay burnt.
I kind of like it. I didn't even think about that.
Stay toasty.
I mean, what else we have? We have you guys are hot. Burners? I don't know. Don't stay away from the stove.
Don't put your hand on
there's something there.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out next time.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
All right, guys. We are here with the man himself, Neil Avron. He produced the album that we've been talking about, From Under the Cork Tree by Fall Out Boy. It's one of the most important albums in emo and pop punk history. And, Neil had a hugely helping hand in that record. So we're going to dive into it with Neil and hear all about what went into making this album. How are you, Neil?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being here. This is cool.
No, it's really exciting because what this podcast is sort of it's diving. It's not just album reviews, right? It's taking a look at the time period and what that was like and what the the artists were like, what they're going through, what the producers, everybody involved was going through at the time of making this album. So it's a little bit more, you know, it's not just like, this song is good or this song is bad. It's like, what was it? What did this feel like? So thank you for taking the time, man. This is really cool for us.
Awesome.
So Neil, when you first started working with Fall Out Boy, what was your initial impression of the band?
Well, I've kind of told this story before, but you know, maybe people listening to this podcast haven't heard it. Essentially, demos came my way through their label, and the first set of demos that came through were good, but I didn't feel like there was super strong songs at that moment. And I relayed that essentially to their A&R person and said exactly that. I feel like there's some cool stuff here, but I don't feel like, you know, we've got like the singles kind of a thing. And he said, okay. And, you know, for all I know, the record could have just gone at that point and I would not have been part of it. But thankfully he came back. I don't remember how long, maybe another month later or something, month and a half. And he sent me a CD or a cassette, who knows at that time, I can't remember, probably a CD, and said, number 2 and 3 are your singles. He wrote me a little note, you know, here's your fucking hit singles kind of thing. And so I listened to it, and there was Sugar and there was Dance Dance. And I was like, yeah, this is more like it. And you know, nobody knows what's going to be a hit, but they definitely felt more like singles to me. And from there, the label flew me out to Denver, where I met the band. They played a live show. I watched them live. And then after the show, we walked across the street to a Thai restaurant, hung out, and agreed to make the record. And that was kind of the start of it.
So, I mean, you know, before you did this, there's a couple of like pop punk stuff you've done. Like, I love the Everclear album. I love SR71. Was like a crazy album for me. I thought that I really was like, oh, this is the next thing. And it didn't like go as far as I thought that it should. But you know, you've done some incredible albums in this genre. Is this like, is Fall Out Boy the type of music that, you know, you listen to, or was this type of music in your rotation? Like, what do you listen to? Like, what do you still listen to? Like, because all of those, you know, those things like the Everclear and Newfound Glory is like, they sound vastly different, but going into From Under the Cork Tree, you know, I feel like it was a lot of change from even the smallest changes, like from what you've done previously. Sorry, there's a couple questions in there.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting question. And I don't know that I've ever actually gotten asked that. What I'd say is this. I didn't come up kind of being a scene kid at all. You know, I was older than, you know, backing up, essentially with Everclear, I had worked with Everclear after I had worked on the Wallflowers record. And Everclear was more of a rock thing than the Wallflowers. Even though Wallflowers was a rock thing, it was more, I don't know, it's more Americana rock, I guess, mm-hmm. You know, more in the vein of a Tom Petty in that kind of a scene. You know, growing up, I listened to all kinds of music. You know, I had an older brother and an older sister. One of them was more into singer-songwriter kind of stuff. And the other one was more into Southern rock. And my tastes, I grew up playing jazz, but my tastes were more towards the Beatles or those kinds of pop acts. And listened to a lot of jazz, Stan Kenton, big band stuff in particular, Miles Davis, Maynard Ferguson, Bill Chase. And those are things that I kind of grew up on. And then when I started working in studios, a lot of the studios I worked in were doing rock music. And so I got exposed to a lot more guitar-based stuff, and engineering and recording and producing. My heart lies in places where there's great melodies and great songs. And really, that's what it boils down to me. It's not so much the genre of music, because I like all kinds of genres. But for me, that's where I feel like I can dig in the most as a producer. And after I did I don't know if it was after the first Everclear record, because I did 3 Everclear records. But after one of those records, I know Chad from Newfound really loved the Everclear records. And that's how I got involved with Newfound. And that was really the first, you know, in that kind of pop punk genre record that I really did. They took a chance on me in that regard. And we had good success on that record. And I ended up making 3 more Newfound records and Ocean Avenue before I even ever got to Corktree. So I was very steeped in that genre. And, you know, it just so happens, as I'm sure you've heard, you know, with the music industry, when you have a hit in a particular genre, you know, a lot of people in that genre kind of gravitate towards you. And fortunate for me, Fall Out Boy was one of those bands that, or artists and the A&R person that thought I could do a good job producing the album. And that's kind of the background on it.
Did you think that you were like, is when you were, you know, starting out as a producer, is this the lane that you saw yourself going in, or was this, is this, did this like take a drastic turn and you're like, shit, now I'm in pop punk?
A little bit of that, but honestly, you know, when you're starting out, you're just grateful you're getting work. So I'd say I didn't really give it that much thought. I mean, honestly, the first time I kind of got that thought wasn't when I started Newfound. It was like in the middle, and the band was like, hey, you got a mullet and we're getting rid of it. And so they brought in their friend to give me a haircut and throw pomade in my hair. So it was like, oh, shit, I'm in. So I think from then it was just like, you know, I love the music. When I met with Chad and the band, the whole band, I keep saying Chad, but the band, you know, they were like, we want to be hard rock, you know, a la Everclear, I'm sure, you know, with guitars, but we want our vocals to be kind of pop, like a Britney Spears. And so somehow I was able to help them kind of get that vision. And they trusted me. And I think doing that and Sticks and Stones and then Catalyst, and then I'm sure Yellow Card saw those things. And that's kind of how I got involved with them. And, you know, it just kind of all snowballed. So, no, I didn't necessarily see myself in a pop punk lane. And I don't know that I saw myself in a specific lane, to be honest with you. Like I said, I like all kinds of rock music and pop music. And so I don't know that I was at the point. I was just like, whatever lanes I can get into, let's go.
For sure. That's cool. TJ, I think you're muted, brother.
So I've met Pete in passing once or twice at this time, but I don't really know him very well. But everything I've read about him and the band is that he has a very clear vision for the trajectory of the band, how the band should sound, how the art should look. You know, everybody says like he always saw it from the very beginning. So when you guys sat down together at that Thai restaurant, what was sort of like the elevator pitch or the overall vision going into making From Under the Corktree?
From Pete, you mean, in particular, or the band in general?
Sure, yeah, or yeah. Like where you guys met in the middle. Like what was your guys' vision when you were like, all right, we're going to do this together?
Well, you know, I guess as a producer, I don't necessarily delve into like marketing vision or any of that kind of stuff. But as far as musical vision, I do recall Pete in particular really liking the Newfound records and the heaviness of them. And I think that appealed to him, and he wanted Fall Out Boy to be able to have those kinds of sounds and heaviness to them. And, you know, when I saw the band live in Denver, what I saw was a very engaged crowd. I saw Patrick have this kind of very different, in my mind, vocal sound and style compared to, let's say, others in the pop punk genre. And that really intrigued me. And, you know, watching Joe fly off walls and, you know, and Andy being a great drummer. So I was intrigued. As far as what that vision was, I think the original vision, at least from what I heard from Pete, just in that dinner, was we want this to be a heavy record. I think that was the key for him. And I guess probably because they came from a hardcore background and mm-hmm. they knew they were doing this pop punk kind of music. So I think he wanted to make sure that it still had that kind of underlying heavy, you know, tone to the album. you know, once we got into pre-production, you know, the shape of the album took place. And while Dance Dance, you can't necessarily call that a heavy song, right? It's very much like a pop song, but, you know, it was kind of merging those things. Not unlike Newfound Glory, trying to merge this kind of, mm-hmm. I mean, with Patrick, more of a pop soulful thing mm-hmm. to this kind of heavier rock thing. So I think the overall vibe of the album took shape during pre-production, what it was really going to be like. And me hearing them play the songs live in the rehearsal studio.
Were there any songs in particular that underwent dramatic changes from beginning to end, like even from pre-production to the end, like anything that changed drastically?
I'm sure there were. The one that really I always remember is Sugar, because when that came to me, the verses were completely different. It was very, very slow and plodding verses. And when you got to the chorus, it's like, wow, we're in a different song and this is incredible. And so in rehearsals in LA, I had mentioned to the band that I'm like, this song, you know, this chorus is incredible. I think the verses could be better. And, you know, I'm leaving at like 4 o'clock from pre-production. I said, you know, can you give a shot at rewriting this verse? And so let's say that's Monday. I come in Tuesday and they play me this new option for the verse. And I listen to it and I go, I think that's better, but I don't think that's it yet. I come in Wednesday and they've got a new version. And we went through 5 or 6 versions of that verse until they played me the one that's on the album. And I was like, that feels like the one. And we all kind of agreed together that we had hit on kind of something that was magical, because it's this kind of, you know, the song is in halftime in the choruses. So having this ability to kind of go straight full time in the verses made the song not feel slow and dirgy, which is what kind of all the other verses were doing. So in essence, that song went through a major change, you know, in pre-production.
You know, I think that one of the things that I've always admired about Fall Out Boy, you know, TJ and I came from playing in bands. It's kind of the natural progression. We weren't good enough to do that. So this is what we're doing, right? Like, we're like, all right, we're not going to be able to. And, you know, from being in bands, I remember having just different parts, right? Just different parts, and then trying to mash these parts together to be like, how do I make this a song? Can it be a song? And the thing about Fall Out Boy is every part to me, you know, I believe with, especially from Another Chord Tree, the verses could be, some of them could be choruses. I think some of the choruses could be verses. And it was really, really unique with how catchy and different it was. Was there a challenge of them coming to you and being like, we have all these parts, where do we stick these things? You know, and at least for this album, you know, I noticed even how young I was like, this is a lot of parts, you know, compared to what I was listening to.
Right. I'd say, first of all, I just got to say that both Patrick and Pete are very good writers. So I don't think, in particular on that album, that we walked in going, we have no idea what we're doing and we don't know what songs. It was more of, it's probably more of like, we have 20 songs and we need help dissecting which ones are the ones we should put on this album. Because I think we actually recorded, I don't remember exactly, like 15 songs. It was very common for me, let's say if we're going to put out an 11 or 12 song album, to over-record and do 2 or 3 extra B-sides, or two or three extra songs, knowing that, you know, because I would often categorize the songs like, oh, this is kind of our A-list, and this is kind of our B-list, and that kind of thing. And then these are the songs that I don't feel are, you know, strong enough to make the record. And there are occasions, although I can't remember honestly for this record, there are occasions where I'll say, on this C song, the bridge is incredible. Right. And then we're working through the pre-production on the rest of the record. And we go, you know what? We really need a bridge here. Why don't we merge? You know, and we would have those discussions, and definitely we would do those kinds of things. Again, I don't have a specific off the top of my head. I'd literally have to listen to the album again to kind of try and remember. But those are the kinds of things I'd say we would do more, or be more like, me saying to Pete, hey, you know, do you have any options for other lyrics, you know, for this verse or whatever? And he often did that on his own. He kind of self-edited. But a lot of times in pre-production, we would get into a lot more deeper things that they maybe didn't pay as much attention to. And they're simpler things like, what is the kick drum pattern on this song? And why doesn't the vocal melody go up high here instead of low here? And why don't we do the harmony this way? Or let's do these overlapping backgrounds. And so those, you know, kind of extra production ideas to bring to it. And then also, you know, guitar voicings, we would work on some of that stuff in pre-production as well. So it just, you know, everything was kind of open. It was more about when pre-production was done, we all felt like, or I felt like, okay, the song is there, the arrangement is there, the guys know their parts, we can now go in and record. And what we can worry about more is sonics, good performances, and then from that, any overdubs we want to work on. But Andy knew his parts, Pete knew his parts, Patrick knew, you know what I mean? So, and there was always fine tuning in the studio. Once you kind of hear everything under a microscope, you can realize, you know what, that voicing that we thought worked really well could be done this way or whatever it is.
So the songwriting partnership between Pete and Patrick is, it's an interesting one. You know, Pete famously writes the lyrics, Patrick writes the music. You know, I think there were some documented instances where they would disagree or things would turn into like a physical argument. Were there any particular moments that you remember where there was a disagreement between you and the band or between the guys or anything that you guys like fought over in particular? And are you happy with how it turned out? And, or would you wish, or is there anything that you wish went a different direction?
I'd say for that record, for me, and you know, you'd have to talk to them to get their opinion. But for me, I never felt like we really were fighting about anything. And, you know, that's really not my kind of personality. My personality is much more, let's problem solve. You know, if somebody has an issue with the lyric or somebody has an issue with the melody or somebody has an issue with the guitar part, how do we make it better? What do we do? You know, or you know, a sound that I'm getting up on the console. How do we make it better? If you're not liking this, what are you looking for? How do we make it better? The idea of arguing for me is kind of counterproductive because it's just, you know, there were times certainly where there were disagreements, you know, as far as like fights, any of that kind of stuff, especially on Corktree, I think was, if it was happening, it was happening more in the background. You know, there was a large lounge at the studio we did that album at. And, you know, if I was working with Joe on guitar parts, everybody else was out in the lounge. And so if Patrick and Pete were out there arguing about a lyric or something like that, or, you know, whatever it might've been, I might not even have been privy to it. They argued about it. They worked it out. And by the time they came back into the control room, I had no idea. It wasn't like Pete would come to me and like, Patrick's being an asshole. And Patrick would come to me and Pete's being an asshole. Honestly, we didn't really have that kind of issue. Everybody was really on board. They were gung-ho. They worked really hard. We worked really long hours on that record. It was probably 6 or 7 days a week, 12-hour minimum day kind of things. And, you know, we grinded. And I don't remember anybody really complaining or being an issue.
You know, TJ and I, you know, from working in music for so long, have so many friends that are producers, you know, small and big. And I always ask my friends who are producers, because I get a really varying degree of answer. Sometimes when I show a producer a song, they're like, the song sounds really great. And the reason why they like the song is because of the sounds and how it sounds and not the songwriting. You know, like, I don't think the song is particularly great, but they're like, this is a great song because it sounds great. And I've always gone into it being like, I kind of don't care how it sounds as long as the song is great. Right. And I know like that is just different. That's different. It's different tastes and for everybody. But for you, when you're listening to a song, how do you judge this a song? Is it a mix of all of that? Is it the songwriting, or is it, do you believe that sounds can make a song?
No, I think sounds enhance a song. The song is the song, and a great song can be played on a piano and a vocal, guitar and a vocal, or just be sung, you know what I mean, by a choir. It's still a great song, and it gives you goosebumps. It's not about the dressing. The dressing is the fun part and something that I really love. I'm very passionate about production and how something sounds, but I do understand that's all. It's, you know, it's like the clothes on a person, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter what clothes they're wearing. It's their personality. Are they kind? You know, those kinds of things intrinsically. So I think a good song is a good song. And I think, like you said, you can make it sound like, you know, really underproduced or no production, and it still can be heard as a great song. And it's just, I think that's why people do covers of great songs, right? It's like, here's a different version, but it's still a great song. Mm-hmm. So I think I will say that I don't want to belittle production, because I think it's very important still as well. And I think there are songs, let's put it this way. I'd say if you have a great song and mediocre production, I think more times than not, it can have a great chance at doing something. But if you have great production and a mediocre or bad song, I'd say the chances are very little that anything will happen.
I always just like asking that to producers, because it's such an interesting question, especially in, you know, 2020, right? Like, it's just such interesting.
It's different to, like, let's say during Corktree time, I don't even remember when that was, like 2004, right? Something in that neighborhood. At that point, there wasn't quite the proliferation of home studios and that kind of stuff that there is now, and that we can all, you know, make a record on a laptop in a closet. So when I would get demos, the demos are very rough, right? So you would still have to hear the song. Is the song good? You know, now when I get a demo, it's practically a fully formed record. And it's like, all right, so what are we doing to this thing? It's like, it already sounds like a record. You know what I mean? And sometimes you actually have to do the opposite. You have to see through the production to decide if there's a good song in there. And so it's kind of a very different time. Like, everybody can make a great sounding production. Most everybody can make a great sounding production, essentially. Go on Splice. Hey, here's a great sounding kick drum. Here's a great sounding snare drum and, you know, guitar rig and auto tune. And it's like, okay, it sounds like a modern record, but is there a song there? So it's a different way to tune it. But ultimately, the song is what drives everything for me.
I agree with you. I just, like, that's my opinion, what you said. I'm always very interested, especially with producers, to their opinion.
One thing that I think Morgan touched on at the beginning of the podcast is, you know, kind of what we're trying to provide our listeners. And that is, you know, sort of just like we're trying to not only dive into the record, but just like provide people some context, time period, what things were like, how this album was being made and when it was released. Are there any particular memories or stories that you can remember from making this album that maybe you haven't told before that stick out in your mind?
I mean, the guys had a really good sense of humor. I remember, it's funny because I was looking through some old photos, and I don't have a lot of photos of sessions that I work on, but there was some photos of us literally duct taping the assistant engineer to a chair. And I was trying to remember why we did that. Or I don't even think I was doing it. I think the band was doing it, honestly. And it just kind of gives you a little insight to where their heads were. You know, the studio was a real workspace for me. And for them, it was also a workspace, but I think there was a lot of levity and there was a lot of like boredom. And so I think, you know, doing things like that made kind of lighten the mood and kept things pretty easy in there. I'm trying to remember if there's other, I mean, you know, having Brendan, being introduced to Brendan Urie during the making of that record, you know, Pete, I think, had just signed him recently to his label. And here I am, by the way, thinking, who the hell is this guy? He's like, he's got one kind of record under his belt. And, you know, when I met Pete, he already had like a book of poetry or something out, I think. He had like necklaces, Clandestine, kind of, he had this whole like merch thing going on. It's like, I was really impressed, you know, that he was such a kind of an entrepreneurial spirit. And then he's got this label and he brings in his label guy, Brendan, to come sing on it, who was amazing. And, you know, and I think, I think I'm pretty sure William Beckett sang on the record too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just impressed. Like, he was very deep into the scene and he was just, I don't know. It was, I loved that part of it. And I guess with the Newfound guys, they did that as well. I remember Gabe Supporter was coming in on that record. At that point, he was in Midtown. And there was a real camaraderie amongst the even the bands that were competing for airtime or whatever. But, I, you know, in general, I remember it being, you know, a really great time. And it was fun. And I don't have, I just, they were so kind because at the time I had two younger sons and they were so sweet to them. They, you know, my kids would come down to the studio with my wife and, you know, Pete would just sit on the floor or hang out with them. And they were, you know, they were always playing video games. They had all these crazy video games that they were playing, like when I'm in the control room working. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I think they hated where they stayed. They were like, I had them in corporate housing and I remember them, you know, kind of bitching about that. But other than that, no real other, like nothing's coming to mind other than, you know, we were really given carte blanche to make the record. Nobody really came down. It was just me and the band and we just did our thing. And I think maybe the label came down at the very end to hear songs. But other than that, it was really just us doing our thing.
It's interesting that you say that because I did hear a story that the chorus of Sugar was being questioned by the label. Is that true?
Not as far as I know. As far okay. In what way were they questioning it?
I think that they, from what I read, they thought it was maybe too wordy or just like the lyrics didn't make sense. People couldn't understand what they were. But maybe that's just a rumor. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I never heard that. I don't remember okay. ever getting a call. The only lyric thing that I remember us having a debate over, and it had nothing to do with the record company, it was my thing, was in Dance Dance. The line there, he says he's falling apart in halftime. And I'm like, you know, the layperson's not even going to know what halftime is. I think we should just change that lyric. And to their credit, Pete wrote like 10 other versions of that line and none of them were as catchy. And they just, I was like, all right, I guess that's just the thing. It's just, that's going to be the line. And, you know, I don't think I quite probably grasped, I'm wondering now, I'm trying to think in retrospect, if I was really able to completely grasp Pete's depth of his lyrical content and all his, you know, his metaphors and even kind of blind metaphors where it's like his own metaphor, like nobody else is going to understand the metaphor, right? It's his own thing. And I think, you know, it wasn't until subsequent records where I kind of saw the process, you know, a little bit more clearly. Because like I said, with Corktree, a lot of the things were kind of put together. The songs were already kind of put together. When we got into Infinity, it was a lot more starting from a blank canvas kind of a thing.
I think that's why, you know, one of the reasons why this album's so fun to listen to and why this band is so fun to listen to. It's like, you know, one of those great TV shows, like, I don't know, in my opinion, The Office, like where you can watch it 10 times and you find new things. You know, I think that's a really good point about Pete's lyrics and the depth of his writing. For sure.
Yep.
I think it's really interesting that you did say that you didn't fully grasp the band until you could hear the band later, like in the later things that they've done, which I think is a testament to something that's so unique and different and new that people are like, I don't know if this is going to work. Like, I don't know, because I've never heard anything like this before. And, you know, in your, you know, at the time, were you thinking that this was going to be just another pop punk record, or were you like, did you see the, you're like, this is going to be something bigger and different and really lead and pave the way for other bands to sound like this sound?
I'd probably be lying if I said I thought that. Yeah. So I would say, you know, my instinct would be that back then, the biggest thing for me was, do we have songs? Can these guys play live? You know, when I watch them, you know, and when I see them in a crowd with other people, is there a reaction? Is there like, are people digging what they're singing as well? Is there kind of this groundswell of, you know, and at that point, when I got introduced to Fall Out Boy, I hadn't heard of them. I hadn't heard of Take This to Your Grave. None of that. So it was a very new thing. So I don't think I had any particular vision other than to think, I think they've got some really strong songs, and they have an A&R person who really believes in them, and that's important. And I felt like I could really add something to what they were doing, and I thought that was important as well. But no, I didn't. I mean, again, I think as we got further in, I mean, look, lyrically, I did recognize that this is very different than anything I had worked on before. Much wordier, much deeper, like we were talking about with the metaphors and the kind of comparison lyrics that he would always do in these twists of turns of phrase, something that's kind of a common phrase that he might turn it differently. And then you're like, oh, wow, that's so interesting. And I never thought of it that way. And it's really, it just shows you kind of like his thought process. Right. And I loved that. Absolutely. Like, did I get everything that he was doing? No, but I definitely could see that distinct. Whether or not people are going to love that, you don't know. But when I went to that show in Denver, it was a madhouse, and people loved everything they were doing, and that was a great sign.
I mean, it's an incredible thing to, you know, you can't put the feelings on paper, right? You just have to, it's kind of one of those things you have to see. You can't write an email and be like, this is an incredible band, like, trust me. Like, it's something that we have to feel, and I think that is, like, the beauty of being in music and music in general. I know this is a From Under the Cork Tree situation that we're doing here, but, you know, for you, are there any songs, have you heard any, like, as far as production, what would be like your top, you're like, this is an incredibly, incredibly well produced song. And then on the songwriting side, you're like, this is the best song I've ever heard. And it doesn't have to be, it could be, those two things can be completely separate from Fall Out Boy. I'm just, you know, as your job and as a producer and a songwriter and all of the mixer, I'm always interested.
Wow. I mean, I don't think I could ever label anything best because there's so much wonderful material out there, but I, you know, wonderful songs, wonderful productions. I mean, you know, I love George Martin for what he did with the Beatles. Stuff that Trevor Horn does is incredible. I mean, he's much more on the overproduction side in a way, but I think his stuff is great, you know, and in a completely different direction, somebody like Daniel Lanois or Brian Eno, I think are magical, you know, in kind of our genre, you know, that we're talking about, the pop punk stuff. I loved everything that Jerry Finn would do. You know, I mean, there's lots of people. I mean, I wouldn't even be able to go on and just naming tons of people, but I think, you know, I got to work with Tom Dowd, you know, many, many years ago. I don't know if you or your audience would know who he is. Look him up. He, you know, he's kind of one of the godfathers, honestly, of engineering and production, in particular in rock, the rock world, and R&B stuff, because he did kind of all the Stax stuff, and he worked for Atlantic, did a lot of work for Atlantic, you know, Aretha Franklin, Sam and Dave, and, you know, legendary. And, you know, people like that who really understood artists, understood songs, and was there to really just take the artists to the highest level that that artist could be. Those are the people I really love. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a Trevor Horn style production where it's really like, you know, Owner of a Lonely Heart kind of a thing where there's things like popping out everywhere, or if it's more just, hey, here's a representation of the band live, you know, and you can really get into it. You know, Fall Out Boy is somewhere in the middle, but it's mostly here's the band live for the most part. Obviously there's extra harmonies and percussion and organs and other things in the record, but really this is what, you know, when you go see the band live, you're going to hear the songs generally speaking this way.
Amazing. Well, man,
Neil, thank you so much for joining us on CD Burners. We appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. This was a really insightful and interesting conversation, and thanks for your contributions to the scene. Like, holy shit, your track record's unbelievable. So it's an honor to speak with you today, and thanks for being here.
Sam, appreciate you reaching out, and this has been fun.
I could do this for every single one of your albums, man. I really like, you don't want to get, I like could do this for 10 more hours. So I'll shut up. But I just want to say thank you. You know, it's amazing to talk to, you know, like these legends that we, you know, that we grew up listening to and still listen to today. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, let's do it again some other time on another record.
All right, man. All right, sounds good. Have a good one. All
right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, Neil.